With your Amex card, entertainment benefits like special ticket access and pre-sales to select can't-miss events while supplies last, make every tap music to your ears.
Getting ready to take on spring? Make your first move with the reliable performance and power of Steel battery tools. From hedge trimmers and mowers to string trimmers and more, right now you can save $50 on select battery tool sets. Real Steel. Offer valid on select AK system sets through June 16, 2024. See participating retailer for details.
Hey, everybody knows Weber grills. I've been using Weber grills my whole life, and check it out. They got a pellet grill, the Weber Searwood pellet grill. Now, with a pellet grill, you can smoke, roast, and sear on the same grill. You can go from low and slow, okay, on smoke boost mode, or crank this thing all the way to a heat sear at 600 degrees. It's got a full great sear zone, so you can put more food on the flame. Get fired up for your new Weber Searwood pellet grill.
The Volume.
How could he do that?
Are you on drugs? What?
Charles Darwin.
The nerves is where it's at.
Welcome everybody back into Nerd Sesh. As always, I'm Carson Brever, and alongside me is Logan Camden. And today we are going to be discussing why Karl Anthony Towns is the player that we would still want to build our NBA franchise around. Logan just had that take before the show. We are going to be talking some basketball, and we are going to talk a little football at the end just because we have some news breaking. But we're going to start with the NBA. And Logan, the Boston Celtics, outside of the one game that they lost to the Denver Nuggets, very close, that we talked about last week, they just continue to mow people down. They're 52-14 now. So at this stage in the season, who do you view as the biggest threat to them out East?
I want to preface this by saying that if Boston doesn't come out of the Eastern Conference, I think it's a travesty and a stain on their resume unlike any other. I mean, you just said it. Yeah, you just said it with the record and the caliber of players that Boston has accumulated here. Like, if they get knocked off, this is a complete failure. This is an embarrassing playoff run for them. For me, Carson, I think it has to be one of my favorite teams, the New York Knicks. And the reason I say that it's the Knicks is because I think Boston has to have somebody that matches up with them physically, athletically, and size-wise. Boston not only is an uber-talented team, they're great skilled-wise offensively, and they're great defensively in terms of just ability. But when you look at the physicality that they have over other teams, you have two really big guards, Derek White and Drew Holiday. You have two really big, physically strong wings, Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum. You've got a really big, stocky guy on the low block in Al Horford. I just mean that in terms of build. He's not a really long guy, but he's a strong, stout guy. And then Porzingis is just an athletic and physical mismatch, you know, very unique in the NBA. You know, I mean, there's not really many guys built like him. 7'3", long as hell, one of the best rim protectors in all of basketball this year. So the first criteria that I think you have to check as an Eastern Conference team is just you have to match up with them physically. And I think New York really does match up with them in terms of what they can do schematically. I think I'd put, you know, Ananobi or Randall on Brown and Tatum. I'm putting Mitchell Robinson or Hardenstein on KP. Like, you just have to match up physically with them. Boston is number one in rebounds per game. The Knicks are fifth in rebounds per game. And I think they can hang there. Obviously, it's not going to be perfect. Jalen Brunson is going to be a defensive liability against anybody on the court. He's just undersized. And again, Boston has so many guys with overwhelming physical advantages. So it's not going to be apples to apples, but you have to check that box. And the other teams to me, Carson, just really don't. Miami, I like. They've gotten better. You know, I like Jovic and Triple J in the lineup. But, you know, I just physically, I think Boston is going to overwhelm them. That being said, I thought that last year. I don't know, man. Miami always has a rabbit in their hat, so we got to put that little asterisk next to Miami anytime we bring them up, sadly.
Sure. This Boston team is different, though, man.
I
know people think that people say that every year. I don't say that every year, okay? Yes, I thought they were going to beat Miami this year, but this is a different beast, this Boston team.
I concur. Are you a different animal but the same beast?
That is how I identify, yes.
What the F does that mean, Kobe Bryant? The Bucks, I just don't trust enough defensively. I definitely considered Milwaukee when you have a combination of Giannis and Damian Lillard, but I don't know, man. There's too many lapses in their defensive coverages. They allow penetration way too easily, in my opinion. I think Boston would feast on Milwaukee in a series. And then it's like the Cavs. I don't know, man. So to me, it's clearly New York. And the only thing that can really limit New York is the thing that has limited them time and time again, and that's either injuries or that's Julius Randle failing on the biggest stage. But I think New York matches up with them physically, man. I think they can hang on the glass. I think they match up defensively. And effort and energy is a category that I don't have to worry about with the Knicks, man. They're going to bring it every night. They're going to play hard. They got guys that do the little things. And I think this is a much better cast of role players than they had last year in the playoffs, man. I like DiVincenzo into the fold. You know, I like Josh Hart coming back. I think their rotation's just a lot better. And again, yeah. Physically, I don't think there are many teams that match up well with Boston, but I think the Knicks can hang physically. Again, that being said, I think a good series for the Knicks in a hypothetical against Boston is like losing in six games. There isn't really a world I envision in which the Boston Celtics don't come out of the Eastern Conference.
I would be very surprised. Can't say it's impossible, but I would be very surprised. They are really overwhelmingly talented. I really want to say the Knicks to this question because since adding OG Anunoby, this team has just been a wrecking ball, and we didn't get to see that for over a month after OG debuted with the team because then he was hurt. But now he's just come back for the last couple games. They're 14-2 when he plays. They outscore opposing teams by 27 points per 100 possessions when he is on the floor. They are so absurdly great defensively. And like you said, they check a whole ton of those boxes. When you're thinking about matching up with Boston, but really translating to that physical playoff environment no matter what. They are a great rebounding team. They are a damn good team defense with dudes who can defend at the point of attack with an all-world defender like OG Anunoby, with a really good interior defender, really good rebounder in Hartenstein, and if Mitchell Robinson does come back, then they have two of those guys. They have significantly improved shooting. Last year, this was one of the weaker spot-up shooting teams in the league. This year, they are one of the better spot-up shooting teams. If you have Dante DiVincenzo and OG Anunoby on those wings compared to an ice-cold Quentin Grimes and a very inconsistent Josh Hart, like those being the guys you had to rely on last year, there's just a totally different complexion to this offense, and life is made easier on your two-star shot creators. And they can have that formula of two legit star shot creators and shot makers. The one thing that holds me back from saying New York, because I think best case scenario, they are the answer to this question. I just worry about Julius Randle, and I particularly worry about out of rhythm Julius Randle, because we have seen time and again, this is one of the most hot and cold star level players in the NBA. He will have months where he is making 40% of his pull-up threes, and he will have months where he is making 25%, if that, of his pull-up threes. And that completely determines who he is as a basketball player, because he's always going to be reliant on those difficult shots. And he's not great at them overall, but he has these stretches where he's really dangerous. And then it's like, cool, what can we do with Julius Randle? But when they're off, his entire game is off. And we've seen that many times in the playoffs. We saw it last year when he was coming off of a five or so game stretch where he hadn't been healthy at the end of the regular season. And now he's been out a long time. And he should be back with a little bit of time to build the rhythm before the playoffs. But he's just such a red flag to me. But I can see that formula. I can see that formula a bit more easily than anybody else. But the only other team that makes a case, and the team that right now I would still probably lean because I'm so uncertain about Julius Randle, is the Bucks. And I know that you hate the Bucks, and you lump them in with the Cavs and the Miamis of the world. I still think they're a tier above. You wouldn't lump them in with them, or you're saying you're off them?
I mean, they're a tier above. I can't keep disrespecting Milwaukee like this. In the Eastern Conference hierarchy, I think, well, let me put it like this. I actually think I'd put Milwaukee and New York probably in the same tier.
I totally agree.
I would put Milwaukee above them just because of the Julius Randle quotient, but the thing that evens it out a little more is the faith that I have in New York's defense.
Totally. The faith that I have in their defense, the faith that I have in their overall depth. I mean, the number of quality basketball players they have just completely exceeds Milwaukee. I would also say the mentality that they bring, the effort night to night, shouldn't really be an issue in the playoffs, but it is, and they're also younger and they're more athletic, and they are honestly the more physical team at this stage. They're the much better rebounding team. They are just a more complete basketball team. There's no question about that. But Milwaukee has Dame and Giannis, and that's a pretty big deal, man. But I want to make it clear that there was a lot of chitter chatter about, oh my God, the Bucks have turned it around. Obviously, they really struggled early with Doc, but then they had that little win streak. It was a pretty easy stretch of the schedule, and some people were like, talk about the Bucks, talk about the Bucks. I haven't seen meaningful improvement since hiring Doc. They are 11-10. They're 18th in offensive rating. They're 13th in defensive rating. We're looking at a 21-game sample now where, as an overall basketball team, they've been worse, and I don't think that they're meaningfully worse, and I think the defense is slightly improved, but I don't think they're meaningfully better, that's for sure. And we've seen in the last week, they've lost by 35 to the Warriors and the Kings, and I still have issues with the defense, man. I still think that they're prone to overhelping, and I still think that they are just a weak perimeter defense that allows a lot of dribble penetration, and then they struggle to close out on those shooters. I was watching the Kings game, and it's just like Harrison Barnes is having the time of his life, knocking down wide open catch and shoot threes. And I think offensively, although they are still so talented and they're very good on that side of the ball, they haven't figured out how to maximize the Dame and Giannis fit, the synergy there, unlocking what should be an unstoppable pick and roll game. They don't go to it enough. It's not a creative offense. It feels stagnant. They don't have lots of dynamic athletes outside of Giannis. And so they are very reliant on, as we've talked about, just the pick and pop game with Dame and Brooke Lopez. And then Dame has to settle for some tougher pull-up threes because he doesn't have a guy who can threaten the rim as a roller. And just overall, I mean, they don't really have athletic shot creators. Chris Middleton hasn't been out there. When he is, he's not that guy at this stage in his career. And Dame is just laying clunkers sometimes. Like, it's really not that uncommon. He had 10 points on, I think, 2 of 16 shooting the other night. It's like every few games, Dame is going to suck. And he will explode every few games, too. But he's just still not close to the player that we saw last year at this stage. And so when I look at all of these red flags that they have, it's very concerning. Their depth is not that good. Middleton, I just don't know, even if he is healthy, if he's a legit number three at this stage, if he's going to be able to play 30 plus minutes a night. He, to me, is just such a looming question mark. But they have Dame and Giannis. And because they have Dame and Giannis, when those two are on the court together, they have a offensive rating of 122, they have a plus 11 net rating, and they have a 41-18 record when those two guys on the floor, which just like says, hey, they're better than everybody out east other than Boston. And I still think that is potentially the case. New York really pushes them, but the formula of, all right, Dame and Giannis just so resoundingly outplay Tatum and Brown. They are just so clearly winning in terms of our two best guys are the best guys on the floor, period, in this series. I can still see that formula, but it's definitely a long shot. It's a long shot for anyone to beat Boston in the East.
I don't really think I can see it with Milwaukee. It's going to be tough. It starts with what you mentioned about the dribble penetration. It's like just a lot of guys getting caught flat-footed with their feet in concrete. They just allow so many guys to drive past. And I don't know if it's like a comfortable thing, Carson, where they just feel like because they have this back line of Giannis and Brooke, it's like, oh, okay, we'll let them get to the paint and then funnel them into there. It's not a good defense. They're not talented. They don't have a whole lot of guys that are, you know, real defensive pluses. And then it's an effort question too. And I think you hit on a real key thing with the Knicks. I want to focus on them for a second. One, you talked about Julius Randle, and I don't want to act like Julius Randle is this freaking punching bag, because if you're a longtime Nerd Sesh listener and you've been here, every time we talk about Julius Randle, I feel bad because we just talk about the negatives. And
yeah, it's true.
There are positive things that Julius Randle does, right? He's a big physical body. And again, in that hypothetical playoff setting against a Boston, Randle's a really good defensive matchup. You know, he can wall up Tatum. Tatum's not the most physical and imposing driver. He can wall up a guy like Jason Tatum. I think he's a decent defensive matchup for a guy like Tatum, but he can't take the offense out of rhythm. He will settle for these bad mid-range jumpers. He can be a bit of a black hole. But I think you hit on a very big key aspect of why the Knicks' playoff aspirations can be different this year, and it is the shooting ceiling. In last year's playoffs, nobody on the Knicks shot better than 33% from behind the arc. That's embarrassing. And you got to think about the cast of role players that they had. You got R.J. Barrett taking a lot of threes. You got Josh Hart taking a lot of threes. There was this one game where Obi Toppin, I think, shot like 12 three-pointers because they were leaving him on an island all game long. Nobody shot better than 33% from deep. That's embarrassing. And then Brunson is lumped into that, of course, but it's because he's settling and being forced to take a lot of these shots when the offense is out of rhythm. He's trying to find something to claw this team back in. This season, I do think that's a dynamic that has shifted. Totally. Deuce McBride is getting more burn. He's over 40% from deep. Brunson, with the added spacing, is just taking more high-quality looks from behind the arc. He's over 40% from deep. Dante DiVincenzo is on the cusp of 40%. OG is 38%. Boyan is at 36% right now, but, I mean, he's much closer to a 38, 39% three-point shooter. Like, the Knicks have fixed their biggest issue, which was shooting and floor spacing. They are an elite defense. They match up physically. They're a great rebounding team. And then it's just like, again, I don't want to make him the punching bag of Nerd Sesh because we just pick on Julius Randle's deficiency and flaws. But if we can get, and that's, Carson, you hit on the key point. I think it's going to take really looking and really magnifying the last 15 and 20 games or however what the burn is of Julius Randle in the home stretch. What version is he playing like? Is he going to be isolation? I'm getting into the lane. I'm taking my tough mid-range jumpers. I'm going to take the offense out of rhythm, or am I going to play good? And I hate the two Julius Randles that we get, because I will tell you, man, I watch a lot of Knicks basketball, and it is so frustrating because there are stretches, and it's not games, man. It is quarters. It is runs where Julius Randle will be playing great flowing basketball, unselfish, but he will lull himself back into these tendencies. It's the biggest swing factor for the Knicks, man, and it sucks because, I don't know, man, do you feel like Carson, would you take a less, I'm trying to think of a good comparison, like a less talented version of Julius, who maybe is as physically imposing, but he's not going to try to impose his will on the game offensively. Do you feel like the Knicks would be better if they just had a role player that would do those little things and wall up defensively and would just move the ball instead of trying to impose his will? Or do you want a guy that is as talented and volatile as Randle that can explode for these good performances? Like, which player would you rather have on this Knicks team?
I guess it depends on the level. Like, if you're asking me, could they have another OG Anunoby? Because OG's a guy who you wouldn't probably see considered in the same star conversations. Like, Julius Randle is an all-star this year. OG's never going to be an all-star.
Let me ask it like this. This isn't an apples-to-apples comparison, but, like, would you rather have Julius Randle or Jeremy Grant on a team like the Knicks?
I would rather have Julius Randle.
I think so,
and
too.
I don't like Julius Randle. Like you've said, I'm low on him. I think that ultimately for this team to reach their ceiling, there are better secondary shot creators to have than Randle because of his inconsistencies, because of the hot and cold, because of how he can be a ball stopper. But versus Jeremy Grant, there's just a different level of physical imposition. There's a different ceiling. There is a different level of playmaking, even though sometimes Randle is that black hole. There are also stretches where it's like, wow, this guy is getting into the teeth of the defense, and he's creating good shots for our shooters. With Jeremy Grant as your number two offensively, I just think you have a pretty low ceiling. But I can see what you're saying, and maybe the gap there isn't as huge as public perception or the upside, the ceiling that they have respectively would suggest. But I do love this team, dude. I love this team. And if we see good Randle, then I think that would make me say they are the answer to this question. Like without a doubt.
It's like the groundhog seeing his shadow, man.
For real, man. But if I see Julius Randle going into the playoffs and it's one of those stretches when he just can't make a jumper, then I'm petrified of that. We've seen it before. But this is just such a better basketball team than the Bucks. Like, they just play better basketball. They are so much more connected. They are more polished. They have more guys who do the little things. They have more capable playmakers, more capable ball handlers, more capable defenders. They have more good everything except for the Bucks. Very easily could have the two best players on the floor in a series. And we're not talking about these two matching up. We're talking about them matching up against Boston. And I like the specifics of how New York matches up a little bit more against Boston too, because you mentioned the physicality that Boston's capable of unleashing really up and down the roster, right? 2'6", 2'4", stout guards. Jalen and Jason are both very built athletic forwards. Jason doesn't always weaponize that as much as he can, but if he does, then you have a problem. And that's what we saw even Denver struggle with against Jaylen Brown, right? He's just going through guys. He's just too strong. You're going to have a hard time doing that against the Knicks collection of perimeter defenders. OG is going to give anybody fits. Randle, as you say, is at the very least a big physical forward. So I love so much about this team. I just need to see Julius Randle play like the guy he is supposed to be, like the guy he is in these regular season stretches. And then I would resoundingly say New York. But maybe my answer should be New York, because if we're thinking best case scenario, I think the Knicks with good Julius Randle are probably even a better bet to beat Boston than the Bucks are with like great Dame, which is also a question mark at this stage. But I'm more scared of Julius Randle than I am even of this version of Dame.
And the final component to me about why I would give the Knicks the edge over Milwaukee is just the fact that I think Boston has really fresh legs in athletes. Like, I think in the transition game, like, you know, Milwaukee's old, dude. Milwaukee's got a lot of big guys. Like, you know, I just imagine Brooke Lopez getting up and down the floor, Bobby Portis getting up and down the floor. And this is no knock on Bobby Portis or any of those guys, but it's like,
They're older, they're slow.
They're more unathletic. And I just feel like in that seven games against a really fresh, young, athletic team, and I just feel like the Knicks are way more well-equipped to deal with Boston, man. And I hope we get it. I hope we get that matchup, man. I think it'd be a ton of fun.
It would. I would love to see that in the second round. I think that would be a bloodbath. Like, I really could see where it's, all right, the Knicks, because of seeding, they don't make the conference finals, but they push Boston a really tough, physical, uncomfortable six in the second round in Milwaukee, right? Maybe they explode in a couple more games. Maybe Dame and Giannis go crazy and they shoot the lights out in a couple games, but I could see it being an easier, more comfortable win for Boston overall because there isn't that same dimension of physicality and athleticism and all these different dudes on the floor who can make an impact that New York does have.
There are some things that are too good to keep a secret, like how your Amex Platinum card helps you have the perfect trip. I'd like to check into the Centurion Lounge. Or how it seems like you always get those hard-to-snag tables.
Ooh, yum.
And how you get the most out of select can't-miss events. With access to the Centurion Lounge, Resi Priority Notify, and Amex card member benefits at select events, you'll have to share. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
What's up? I'm John Wall.
And I'm CJ Toledano, and we're starting a new podcast presented by DraftKings called Point Game. We're now joined by three-time NBA Sixth Man of the Year, elite bucket getter. Let's please welcome Jamal Crawford to Point Game. King of the Court one-on-one tournament. If they had it back in your prime, do you think he could have took it all?
I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think I could have took it all, but I think I would have shocked a lot of people. I think Kobe and everybody in their prime, Kobe would win a one-on-one contest.
Yeah, because you got to think. He's going to guard. He don't care about guarding.
He's going to guard.
He's going to guard. Like, you see him in the Olympics, he's going to guard. And then on top of
that. Like that, see that?
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Sam Cassell to Point Game.
I remember you came to my room crying tears. I mean, he was in a culture shock. And then he's going to withdraw us about winning.
Remember what I told you? I said, OG, you think I can get paid and go back and play in college because it ain't it?
Check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, DraftKings YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Have a ton of questions about LASIK? You're not alone. That's why we created LASIK.com, one place where you can go to find every answer to every question on your mind. Like, how much does LASIK cost? How long does recovery take? How do I find a doctor? If you've been thinking about LASIK, go to LASIK.com now. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
We're talking about Boston being a class above the rest of the East, though, but the one team that we both still think should be the title favorite above them is the team to most recently beat them, the only team in quite a while, and that is the Denver Nuggets, who are on a four-game win streak of their own, just had an impressive win the other day, putting away the team who they last met in the finals, the Miami Heat. And I want to broaden our perspective a little bit with this question, Logan, because we talk about Jokic's individual status as very possibly the best offensive player ever. How many offenses, when we're talking about the team offense, do you think have been better than these Nuggets this century?
I would say the 2017 to 2019 Warriors simply because of talent.
Yes.
I think when you're looking at that, I mean, I don't even really care who the big man is, dude. KD, Steph, Clay, Draymond at a, you know, as a connector. I don't know if I'd ever put anybody above that collection of talent, man.
It's probably the best offense ever.
Yeah. I mean, but outside of them, and even including that version of the Warriors team, I don't know if I've ever seen a team that makes clutch offense just look so effortless and so easy. They're consistently over a 120 offensive rating in the regular season and the playoffs and the clutch at full health. And I think that's just a testament to the abilities of Nikola Jokic. Ironically, the first two segments of Nerd Sesh here today, classic tropes of Nerd Sesh. One, hating on Julius Randle, and then segment two,
love
praising
it.
Nikola Jokic.
Stick to the brand, bro. Stick to the brand.
So on brand. If you've been with us for a while, you know, Carson was, I want to say, 2 or 3 years ahead of the curve with Jokic might be the greatest offensive big man.
First of all, if I can just make a couple clear statements, there was no might. There was no,
no
might.
No,
it
you
was
were,
over
you
three
were
years ago. Just celebrated the 3 year anniversary about a month ago of me saying Jokic was the best offensive big ever. And they called me a madman. And I do want to address that real quick because I just saw somebody tweet out after I did my video on how Jokic might be the best offensive player ever, saying, Nerds, that's just this video. I agree, of course, but it's funny to see a lot of people hopping on the bandwagon. No, 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 my friend. No, 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 no. You do not lump me into that crew. You do not lump me in, my friend. This has been my thing for a long time.
Carson pioneered the Jokic offensive brilliance. Yeah, it's become consensus now, but you were definitely ahead of the time. And
Thanks, man.
So I don't want to beat a dead horse here when we are praising Nikola Jokic, but that really is the argument that we're having.
Yeah.
How many
be
guys
very disturbed if you beat a dead horse in front of him?
How many guys amplify their teammates quite like him? He's got the unstoppable post scoring, the all the counters. And so I think you just have to look at teams relative to their era, and the only team that comes to even the forefront of my mind that's comparable, Carson, is the mid-2000s Suns and how they were able to optimize offense with Steve Nash, with Amari Stoudemire. And again, I mean, I'm just taking the Nuggets, and the difference is, right, the Suns could run you to death, right? They could run it up, they could have these crazy runs. Denver's unique in the sense that it really doesn't matter where they're in the shot clock or whatever. I mean, at any point, like, they can just slow it down and they can go to their pace and they can kill you. And all the different deliberate actions, if it's a dribble handoff to Jamal, if it's an inverted pick and roll with Nikola Jokic, like, I've just never seen a team that has so many actions that are just unstoppable. And it all does come back to Nikola Jokic. Like, I've never seen a guy like him that just makes it go, man. There's this inevitability that I feel with Patrick Mahomes, when there's 2 minutes left in a football game and he has the ball in his hands with a possession to go and he's going to kill you. And there's a helplessness that I get with Nikola Jokic when there are 6 minutes left in a very close ball game. And it's like, okay, well, unless you force the Nuggets to turn the ball over and you can turn those into points at the other end, it's like if you let them run their normal offense, they're going to convert somewhere between 12 and 20 points in the last 6 minutes and you have to keep pace. I've never seen a team like that. Again, outside of the 2017-2019 Warriors that just effortlessly can fill it up. I think outside of them, man, I think the Nuggets are two. And I don't know, man, is there anybody I'm leaving off? Like, there's so many grimy offenses in the early 2000s. Like, I guess maybe, I don't know, like the LeBron at the peak of his powers with those Cavs teams just because it's freaking LeBron. But again, even them, I'm taking the Nuggets. Like, it's, even that's a more labored version of offense. And what I mean by that is it's LeBron running high-volume pick-and-roll at the top of the key, and he's hoping that a shooter knocks down a shot. Well, one, the surrounding shooters here in Denver are just point-blank period better than the caliber of shooters that they had. And two, I think always with Jokic, he's creating a higher quality shot. If that's a little baby hook on the low block, or if that is him kicking out to a shooter. And it's his tough shot-making, too. We all remember the shot that he hit over Anthony Davis that I still hear Lakers fans complaining about to this day. Oh my God, man, if Jokic didn't hit a bunch of BS shots against us, we win that series. Look, guys, you got freaking swept, all right? Deal with it. It's the fact that I don't think you can stop him, man. I think Jokic is the freaking GOAT, man. So I'd say two, behind the 2017 to 2019 Warriors, man. I don't really think anybody else holds a candle to this team.
Well, I have to disagree if you say don't hold the candle, because the team that definitely holds a candle to them, whatever that actually means, whatever that literally means, to hold the candle to someone.
Yeah, I don't actually know what that phrase means, man.
It sounds a bit disturbing the more I think about it, like perhaps some sort of ancient torture, but it is definitely the mid-2000s Suns. Like, that is one of the tier one offenses ever. Warriors with KD, undeniably number one this century. What Phoenix was doing in the mid-2000s, though, was so head and shoulders above everybody else in basketball. From 05 to 07, they were number one in offensive rating twice, and then they were second one time. That, of course, being when Amari Stoudemire missed the entire year Without Amari, they were the number two offense in basketball and still the number one postseason offense in basketball. And they led three straight postseasons in offensive rating. In 2005, in the playoffs, Logan, they were 5.5 points better than second place in offensive rating. And I focus specifically on this core. 05, you have Joe Johnson. You consistently have Marion and Amari in these years. Then 2010, you have the Jason Richardson, Grant Hill supporting cast. In that year, they were still like an all-time offense, and they led the playoff field by 4.6 points per 100. So really, from 2005 to 2010, it's the second greatest team offensive run that we have ever seen, just over a stretch of that length, to the 80s Showtime Lakers, who were just number one offense, number one offense, number one offense. I do think it comes down to preference between these two, though. And that's not what the raw numbers will suggest. It's just in terms of how much they are outpacing their peers, especially in the regular season. The Nuggets are seventh in offensive rating right now. But we're talking about them in these conversations because of the inevitability when it matters. The floor of this Nuggets offense is absurdly high because of Jokic's interior dominance, because of his absurd shot making, the absurd efficiency, and the ability to create great shots for his teammates around the rim, Aaron Gordon especially. He's so consistently rewarding cutters. And that's something that is so exceptional about this offense, that they are not susceptible to perimeter shot variance in the same way that everybody else in basketball is. Last year, they won two games in the finals with 5 3-pointers made or fewer. Nobody else won a game in all of the playoffs under those circumstances. They did it twice in the finals specifically. We talked about this after their Boston win. They have two games this year that they've won with 4 3-pointers made exactly. That is an incredibly rare feat in the NBA today. So their floor is obscenely high. And I also think their crunch time offense, exactly what you articulated, is unbelievable. I know that Ben Taylor at Thinking Basketball just made a video on this. I haven't had the chance to watch it, but I can imagine a lot of the key points. It is because of their bread and butter actions that are so unstoppable. Murray Jokic pick and roll, especially when you have Aaron Gordon in the dunker spot. Teams are just compromised every single time. And a Jokic post up, teams are compromised every single time. So when you are just trying to grind out, let's get these buckets. We're not worried about necessarily going on these torrid runs, running up and down the floor, jacking up threes. Let's just get 2 points possession after possession after possession. The Nuggets are one of the best offenses we have ever seen point blank because of Jokic and because of the supporting cast and because of their offensive identity overall. On the flip side of that, we can talk about the Nuggets' extremely high floor, how great they are in the clutch. They have an offensive rating of 124 there this year. And just their incredible balance as an offense, how versatile they are. I talk about their bread and butter actions, but we know the handoffs, they're lethal. They do have some of the collective highest basketball IQ in the NBA when you're talking about off-ball movement, guys knowing how to play off of their superstar talent. And I mean, they have the best offensive player ever, probably, which as great as Steve Nash is, he doesn't have that claim. So that level of unstoppability from one individual is another advantage. But the Suns' potential to explode is arguably like nothing we've ever seen. Again, it's them, it's the Warriors, and it's the Showtime Lakers in that tier because of their completely ahead of their time spacing, overall three-point shooting, the volume and the efficiency was absurd, and the fact that they were consistently going to play at one of the fastest paces in the league. And of course, people talk about them being the pace and space offense, 7 seconds or less, and they can focus on the pace. But Steve Nash is the greatest pure pick and roll player that we've ever seen. And he had alongside him some of the great play finishers of the 2000s, the athleticism that you get from Amare and from Sean Marion. Again, the consistent shooting that he had on those teams, like it was just offensive heaven. And so that's why they're outpacing their peers just at a completely different level, even than the Nuggets, who, by the way, last year had the best playoff offensive rating by a champion or tied for it that we've ever seen, which is an incredible feat. Offensive rating is inflated, but still, playoffs, they were head and shoulders above everybody else in terms of their consistency. But the Suns were lapping people by even more. And I just want to clear up why isn't this one of the all-time great teams, these Suns, and it's because they were historically rare in how limited they were defensively. Like, always scrapping to be maybe average defensively, which is rare, which is something the Nuggets do not have. They're a legitimately good defensive team. So I guess my answer to this question would be, over a game, the Suns are probably the better offense because I do think they were more prone to those explosions, and they did that so consistently. It's not like it was a volatile offense. It was just one of the three most dynamic offenses we've ever seen. If I need one bucket, if I need in the last 2 minutes, tie game, who is going to create me the best clutch shot quality, I would probably go with the Nuggets. So I think they're in a very, very similar tier. That's kind of a cop-out answer, though, so I will probably say the Nuggets are the third best offense of this century because of the Suns' just consistency, their dominance throughout an entire game. But I really, really value that clutch offense, that just get me a good shot at will that the Nuggets have in a very, very rare way.
I got a couple follow-ups for you. How do you think modern offenses, let's go Dallas and Oklahoma City, how do you think they scale to these conversations of all-time brilliance?
Dallas and OKC from this year?
Yeah.
They're not up there. I mean, those are two really good offenses, two very unique offenses, especially when you think about what OKC is able to do with the spacing, the variety of ball handlers, the skill that you have from a big like Chet, the combination of change in pace and downhill force from J-Dub and Shea with this incredible shot making, but it's just not at the level of these all-time great offenses, because you have to judge everybody, just like we talk about with players, within the context of their era. And offenses overall are just better because we talk about, oh my God, the Suns are so ahead of their time. They're making 10 threes a game. It's just a completely different sport. So I think those are great offenses. I don't think that they're in these conversations.
All right, I got two more for you. Who do you think is fourth? Is that like the Harden's Rockets?
That's a good question. I definitely considered Harden's Rockets in terms of regular season production. They're up there. I will throw out another Harden team, and this one is a bit tough to fully justify because we didn't see it flesh out, but the 2021 Nets, I think, absolutely would have been here if they stuck it out and if they were healthy in the playoffs. I mean, they posted the best offensive rating we'd ever seen in a regular season. I don't think we've ever seen three shot makers of that caliber on the same basketball team. It was just utterly absurd what they were doing to people throughout that regular season. I would probably go with, honestly, the Nash Dirk Mavs, though. I think if you look at that 02-03 range, they are consistently much better than the rest of the league in terms of their offensive production and efficiency. Again, that's just another team that didn't have the defensive personnel at that stage to make a legit title push. But what you have in terms of two of like the top five offensive players of maybe the 21st century, certainly the 2000s, it was just incredible. The stress that Dirk was able to put on a defense from all over the floor, combined with Nash's brilliance as a playmaker and shooter, even if he wasn't what he was in his son's years. And then you had Michael Finley, who was a legit third star. Like, those teams were a problem. And I also think the 2001 Lakers, I mean, the physical unstoppability of Shaq, what that did to improve the shot quality for all of his teammates with now that version of Kobe, that legit superstar Kobe, especially once you're into like 2001, they were consistent, like the best offense regular season and postseason. So those would probably be the next couple off to me.
Those are good choices. And then I was going to ask, do you think that Phoenix is the greatest offense ever to never win a title?
Without a doubt, not even close. I mean, it's insane. They're one of the top three offenses ever, in my opinion. They never won a title. You have to be, again, rarely limited defensively when we're talking about any contending caliber teams. And they are probably like the weakest defensive team ever to make multiple conference finals, even. Well, Houston was on a different level defensively than those Phoenix teams.
It's sad how close they got every single year, man. And misfortune just got them every single time. If it was suspension, if it was injuries, if it was matchup. Suns got on the cusp a lot of times, man.
Yeah. Hey, North Carolina residents, DraftKings is officially live in your state, and the thrill and excitement of March Mania is here. And DraftKings Sportsbook, one of America's top-rated sportsbook apps, is giving new customers a shot to turn $5 into $150 instantly in bonus bets with any college basketball bet.
Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app now and use code NERDS. New customers can bet $5 to get $150 instantly in bonus bets. Only at DraftKings Sportsbook with code NERDS. The crown is yours. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit www.1800gambler.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY. In Connecticut, help is available for problems with gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly. On behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort, licensee partner Golden Nugget Lake Charles, 21 plus, age varies by jurisdiction, void in Ontario. Bonus bets expire 168 hours after issuance. See sportsbook.draftkings.com/football terms for eligibility and deposit restrictions, terms, and responsible gaming resources.
Well, one of the great offenses in today's league, Logan, is that of the LA Clippers. Another James Harden offense. He has certainly been a key part of some great offenses throughout the recent history of the league. But as a team, they haven't been so great as of late. They won last night, but over the last quarter of the season so far, they're 8-8. They're a 500 basketball team. And they have been like the presumptive challenger to the Nuggets out west recently, at least since they started really clicking post-Harden trade. Are you cooling on them at all?
A little bit. You know, I'm not panicked, but I would say I'm cooling on them. Ninth in offensive rating over that stretch, 26th in defensive rating, and 17th in net rating. You know, it's funny, Carson, their wins aren't that impressive. They're beating, you know, average teams, and their losses are against good teams. They lost twice to the Timberwolves, twice to the Bucks, to the Lakers, Kings, and Thunder. All of those teams, you know, presumptively, they could get matched up, except for the team out east, obviously the Bucks, they could get matched up with in the playoffs. A lot of this, I think, has to do with shooting variance. You know, the Clippers are very three-point dependent. Not been shooting well. Kawhi shooting 30% from behind the arc on 4.5 threes a game. Harden shooting 34% from behind the arc on nearly 8 threes a game. On the season, this is a team that's second in three-point percentage, nearly 39% during this stretch. They've been league average below 35%. You know, this is the Clippers' bread and butter. They generate a lot of perimeter looks. If they're not shooting well, well, they're not going to play well. And with that is they're not a very physical team, overwhelmingly size-wise. You know, you're running Kawhi at the four. Inherently, they're just not a great rebounding team. So when they're not shooting well and you're not grabbing boards, it's just a recipe for disaster. They're 25th in rebounds per game over that stretch, and they're 19th on the season. They're just undersized, so they got to get boards. Injuries have been a component of this. Russ has been injured. Kawhi and PG have been dealing with sporadic injuries. I think the defensive effort has been pretty poor. Again, I mentioned 26th in defensive rating. Out of rotation, poor effort and energy. And then the guy I'm going to point my finger to is Paul George. Paul George has not been great. You know, he's been better over the last 15, over 20 points per game, 40% from deep, a little more efficient. But in the stretch before that, he's under 19 points per game. He's shooting under 39% from the field, 34% from behind the arc. Like, I don't know, man. This team isn't gelling perfectly. There's some effort concerns. It's all these things. And it is very concerning coming into the playoffs, especially when I think that's the formula that Los Angeles has to have to beat a team like Denver. I think they got to shoot the lights out. I'm talking 40% from behind the arc, flame throwing, really stretching out a defense. And I don't know if I trust Paul George and James Harden and, frankly, Kawhi Leonard enough to put my faith in this team to come out of the West. With Kawhi, it's a straight-up injury thing. You know, I this is a freak injury because Kawhi's been healthy for most of this season. It sucks. I think he took a knee to the back, and that's why he was having back spasms. Had to leave that Timberwolves game. Timberwolves storm back. They win.
But he's fine. I mean, he was back last night.
You know what I mean, though? But I'm just saying on the whole, it's like this is a consistent thing with Kawhi. So the one thing with Kawhi isn't ability, it's health. And again, his touch has been off. Harden, it's about him getting into the teeth of the defense. It's this thing that we harped on when they made the trade. Harden, when he's drawing these matchups against lesser perimeter defenders, I think he's got to make a concerned effort to not just settle for the shot when it's not falling. Like, I want to see Harden get into the lane. I want to see him to create. He's a good playmaker. Harden's always a good playmaker, but I want to see him get into the teeth of the defense just a little more. And then Paul George, I don't know, man. Paul George just has not been Paul George level this year. And I don't know. I've been pretty consistently disappointed with Paul George's play this year. If it's as a playmaker, if it's with the ball in his hands, if it's as a shooter, he'll have stretches, but it's not been consistently great enough for me to believe in him at another level. And then when you get to the outside of the stars, when you get to the team level, do I trust this team defensively enough surrounding them? Well, no, they're kind of at a lack of great perimeter defenders and size outside of their top two. On the interior, they've got Big Zoo, and then everybody else, it's like we're playing Tyson Plumlee. You know, we're pretty undersized. So there's a lot of red flags with LA. The size, the consistency of their stars, the shooting variance. I can see it. I can see the path, much like when we saw the Clippers make that run with Paul George. Yeah, there's definitely a path, and there's a way that I can see them doing it. It's the stars playing back up to expectation. It's them shooting the hell out of the ball, and that's Big Zoo anchoring the interior. But I'm definitely a lot more cool on LA, and I don't really know who my second favorite is out west anymore, Carson. I don't know. Again, it's going to be very – I think this year, because of how close it is between these teams, moreover than anything else, it's going to be matchup dependent, right? Like, I like Oklahoma City in a lot of matchups, but I don't like them in certain ones. I like Dallas in a lot of matchups, but there are certain ones that I don't like. I guess Dallas would – and it's weird, man. It's weird taking a play-in team. Dallas might be my second favorite just because of the offensive ceiling that I get with Luka and Kyrie and then the play of their interior bigs. I'm serious when I say that Derek Lively and Daniel Gafford and P.J. Washington changed the complexion of a series. Maybe not P.J. as much, but Gafford and Lively wholeheartedly changed the complexion of a series for me just because Gafford is going to finish really well around the rim. He's going to take great shots, and he's going to rebound, and he's going to block. He's going to block shots on the interior. He's going to take away the interior. So, yeah, man, I think it's so weird picking play-in teams as my favorite, but I think it would either be Dallas – I guess it would be L.A. God, I hate taking the Lakers to do anything anymore.
Wow. Wait, so you are way out on the Clippers.
I don't know. I mean, the Clippers have a lot of red flags when they're undersized. I don't know if I can believe in their stars, and I don't know if I can trust the shooting variance. There's a formula. I'm not saying there's not a formula, but it's like the Lakers can physically impose their will over other teams. Anthony Davis is a matchup nightmare for certain centers. The Mavericks just have a different kind of scoring punch and faith that I have with Luka and Kyrie. I don't know, man. I'm slowly souring on the Clippers a little bit. Yeah.
Interesting. I think some people got too high on them, and it was kind of obvious and inevitable. There's Denver fatigue. The media doesn't like Denver. They're not excited. They're not aroused by them. And so it was like, ooh, we love James Harden. We love Kawhi Leonard. We love Paul George. Those guys have been good for so long. Let's say that they're going to beat Denver. And that was always silly. I thought they always had more clear weaknesses. They didn't have the same sort of unstoppable offense that Denver does because of what we talked about, the consistent shot quality and the fact that they're not susceptible to shot variance in the same way that every other offense in basketball is. But I still think LA is number two for me. And the reason that I'm not panicking about this stretch is that I feel like some regular season malaise and a dip in their regular season defensive level was just going to happen. You have the initial brutal adjustment when James Harden comes in and it's like, all right, figuring things out is rough.
Gosh.
Yes. You honestly, I frightened me a little bit there. What's up?
Wow, this just broke. This has nothing to do with the NBA. The Steelers just traded Kenny Pickett to the Eagles.
Whoa. Whoa. What's your take? Live podcasting. It's thrilling.
I just didn't expect this to happen.
Bro is heartbroken.
Wow. So we lose Mason Rudolph and we lose Kenny Pickett. Wow. The Steelers are going to get a third. This is a third and a seventh for a fourth rounder in Kenny Pickett. Wow.
Wow. Wow. That is really interesting.
I was not really prepared for, I guess Pickett was frustrated, didn't want to be in. I mean, we all kind of knew that he wasn't going to be the starter after we traded for Russell Wilson. I mean, that was consensus, but I was definitely not anticipating Pickett being on the move.
That's very interesting. A little bit sad for the guy. I mean, he's just going to be a backup for the foreseeable future. But that's what he is. That's what I've been saying, Logan. Very low-end starter, high-end backup. I know you like that he plays it safe, that he doesn't turn the ball over too much.
I mean, that's the role of a backup, man. If you come in there, you handle business, you don't do too much. No, I didn't think Kenny was a starter after his first 2 years either. I thought he was pretty defensive. I mean, if Mason Rudolph's better than you, I mean, you're not a starter, bro. Like,
yeah.
That's borderline, and that is a limitation of a quarterback like that. When you're not putting – it's ironic. When you're not putting the ball in harm's way, you're also not putting the ball in the opportunity to have these shot plays. I also think that Kenny was unfairly criticized because you have to understand that his offensive coordinator for the majority of all of his starts was Matt Canada, so I wanted to take a lot of his play with a grain of salt. The Steelers' offense drastically improved under Eddie Faulkner and Sullivan. Wow, man, I'm kind of shocked. But I wish the best for Kenny, man. I hope he finds success as a backup in Philly.
I do wonder, just considering how cheap the Titans got Mason Rudolph. Like, if you knew you were gonna do this, why wouldn't you sign Mason Rudolph to a contract that cheap?
Yeah, and he's already been there. He's already been there. I mean, how many seven years now?
Obviously played his best football ever in the home stretch of last year, and you just wouldn't have to invest much at all. Then you would have two super cheap but like kind of starter caliber guys with both him and Russ in the same room. That surprises me that they would move on from Kenny and not do that, because now what do you think they're going to do at backup? Draft somebody late?
I mean, our options, the free agent quarterbacks on the market right now are Carson Wentz. Who are the – I saw a couple other guys that are still free agent. I mean, it's – we're talking bottom of the barrel here. Justin Fields maybe would be the move.
We could always get Nathan Peterman.
We get Russell Wilson and Justin Fields in the same offseason, get Fields to be a backup. If the option's picking somebody late, I would hope maybe – this is going to sound kind of crazy. Because, I mean, we have no future unless Russ is our future at quarterback. Like, Russ is going to have to ball out.
Well, he's not really going to be your future anyways.
Trade up in the second round if Michael Penix slips or Bo Nix slips? I don't know.
Very interesting. Very interesting. There's a little bit of breaking news. I'm going to get back to my Clippers take now. What I was saying, Logan, before you screamed in my ear like perhaps you had witnessed a murder in a Hitchcock movie, is it's not surprising to me that we saw this team comprised of veteran stars in their 30s take a little bit of a dip for a stretch of the regular season. They kind of proved their point. They were beating the brakes off of everybody, and now they've sucked defensively for these past 15 or so games. They're 26th in defensive rating. That just doesn't shock me. I will say that is a concern with this team. What is the ceiling that they can reach defensively when I still think that Kawhi and PG are very good, and with Terrence Mann, you have a guy who can hassle people at the point of attack, and Zubats is like a good pure rim protector and rebounder. They have good pieces defensively. They just don't have great pieces. They don't have a real secondary rim protector, right? Kawhi and PG are specifically about those wing matchups. Harden still isn't great. So I think that they can be an above average defense. I think they're better than they have been because of effort, but I don't love their ceiling there when you're talking about against the elite teams in basketball, and that's always been something I've flagged with them. And I also do think, specifically in this very recent stretch with Russ out, the bench units are just a little bit rough. Like, you got to give Russ some credit for the juice that he provides, the athleticism, the playmaking, his ability to create shots for teammates in those lineups. Now we're just getting a lot of Bones Highland. We're getting a little bit more Amir Coffee than normal, and I do think that has taken a little bit of a hit on this team as well. So I'm not out on them. I still think that they're number two out west for me, because they do have this really impressive combination of absurd shot making, of three legit star shot creators, of good role players in depth who I do like when Russ is healthy at the very least. I like the complementary nature of Zubats and Terrence Mann in the starting five, and I really like Norman Powell, his ability to explode offensively. And there is still more physical maturity there than you get from an OKC or whatnot. Versus Dallas, I just think the role players in LA are better, and they have that third legit star. So they're still number two for me, but it's Denver and then it's everybody else. It's not Denver and LA and everybody else. It's Denver and then everybody else, but I still have them at two. I'm not freaking out about them. All right. One more basketball topic, Logan, and then we'll get to the NFL news that goes beyond Kenny Pickett. I've seen a little bit of interesting discourse as of late about the Most Improved Player Award, because some people are complaining that they feel like we've lost the spirit of the award, that now it is going much more to guys who are taking that star leap, and maybe we're even high draft picks. If it's Brandon Ingram, if it's John Morant, guys who were the second overall pick, it's like, how shocked can you be by that guy taking a leap? We want more Ronnie Cycles. We want more, well, Purvis Ellison was the number one pick, but he's a guy who took a leap unexpectedly. Didn't matter. The team sucked. But I saw some complaining about that, and I do think it's a really interesting race now. So with about a quarter of the season left, a little bit less, who do you think deserves Most Improved Player?
I'd give it to Coby White. I think it is an interesting race. And I do think it's an ideological, kind of how you come down on it. You know, do you value more the guy that came from really low and improved to being a starter or a role player? Do you value the guy that, you know, was a role player and turned into a star? And to me, it's just the guy that grew his game the most. I want to give a ton of credit to one of your guys, one of our guys, Nerdsesh OG, even back to his days at Duke, Jalen Johnson. I think
Shout out.
I mean, again, to go from he's getting 15 minutes per game last season to 34 minutes a night, that's not for, you know, no reason. Like, Jalen's legitimately a good player. I think he compliments Trae Young. But when I think about it, too, it's not just where you came from and how much better you have improved this season. It's how much are you actually impacting the game? How much are you really transforming your team? And to me, the guy that's done that the most this season is Coby White, especially with where he came from last year. 23 minutes a night, was not starting, was basically just a six man, averaging sub 10 points per game, three boards, three assists on decent efficiency, to now he's averaging 25-5 on 45-39-84 splits with 37 minutes per game. And it's not just raw numbers, raw efficiency from playing so much better. It's leading to winning and good offense. The Bulls have an offensive rating of 116.3 with Coby on the floor. Without Coby on the floor, they have an offensive rating of sub 110. You know, they're one of the worst offenses in the league. Coby is awesome, dude. Coby is disgusting. What he did with the Kings a couple weeks back, man, that was nasty. But Coby's just a good offensive player, man. He's one of the best perimeter shooters in all the league. He's a great pull-up shooter. He's crafty at getting to the hoop. Like I said, man, he just, it means something. And you see it in Chicago's offense. DeMar can be a bit of a ball stopper. He's obviously the most talented guy on the court. And in some games, like when he just almost hit that 50 piece the other night against Indiana, that was disgusting, man. DeMar closed that game out really effectively. But Coby and Ayo are the guys that make this offense really go, man. And Coby especially, he's grown so much skill-wise. Like, I don't remember Coby just being this effective, dude. He's grown as a playmaker. He's just really rounded his game out, and he's a really, really effective winning offensive basketball player now. And again, coming from a guy who was barely cracking the rotation, he's one of the best spot-up players in all of basketball. I love Coby, and I think from where he came, especially, too, when you talk about these guys who, second or third year, whatever. I mean, Coby's been in the league a minute, and I think after last season, a lot of people kind of had their minds made up on what he was. He's a six man. This is a guy that you're going to bring off your bench, be a little spark plug. He's not that. He's way more. He's a winning offensive player, and I think Coby's got more room to grow, man. I don't think he's done as an offensive player. I think he can be even better. But from where he came last year, from the consensus of what Coby was as a basketball player, I think he's changed a lot of perceptions. And his game has legitimately grown. He's more skilled than last season. So I'd give it to Coby, man. I just think he checks all my boxes.
I think I would give it to Coby, too. But it is a really interesting race. There's a lot of good candidates, and there are very much guys who fall into two different groups, which kind of relates to what we were talking about with that philosophical discussion about what should this award be rewarding? Because you have Ja Morant and Brandon Ingrams and Julius Randle even, although that was a pretty clear one, but that's a guy who was once a really high draft pick, and then it was kind of like, all right, who is he? And now he takes a star-level All-NBA leap. And then you have the guys who improved to being kind of nobody to just being good. And I think Coby is closer to that second mold in that he's not an actual star at this stage, but he is really good. And also in that group, I would say you have Jalen Johnson. As you mentioned, just an awesome, versatile, winning basketball player. You have Jonathan Kuminga, who, again, isn't at a star level right now. Very well maybe on that trajectory. Or especially over the course of the season, his production wouldn't say that. But since January 12th, the guy's dropping over 20 a night on 62% true shooting. Last year, he was under 10 a game. It was kind of uncertain. Like, how important is Kuminga to the future of this team? Even early in this year. And now we have just seen, okay, when he leverages his physicality in isolation on post-ups, he's just a problem to deal with out in transition, and he's producing at this really impressive level. So you have those guys who it's like, all right, they were kind of teetering on just how good are they, to now these are really good basketball players. Then you have, okay, very, very good young player now takes leap to sort of undeniable stardom. That's Tyrese Maxey, who has been the presumptive favorite this entire year. And that's also Şengün, who just has had such an impressive season, averaging 21-9-5 on 59% true shooting for at least a decent team to be a legit number one. Very impressive. You can throw Scotty into that mix, absolutely. I think that those are all of the contenders. And I do think that the leap to stardom is very valuable. That's why I don't have a problem with most of these recent winners. It's like, if you go from being quality starter to, hey, I'm a legit star, I can be a number one on a good team or a number two on a great team, like, that is way more valuable than what some of these guys in the 90s did, where it's like, okay, cool, Don McLean can put up empty numbers on an actual garbage Washington team. So can Purvis Ellison. Or some of these are even weirder when you think about, like, Isaac Austin winning in 1997 because he came from outside the league, overseas, and then he was just like a decent rotation player on a good team. But that is not as meaningful a leap as going from good to star. But I do think I'm more surprised by Coby White's leap, and it is legitimately really impressive. It's not an Isaac Austin leap. It is like, this guy is a building block. This guy matters to you long term. His development as a playmaker has been impressive. He's established himself as one of the league's legit best shooters, both in terms of pull-up shot making and off the catch. He is just jittery and quick enough to get to the rim at a decent clip. He's not a great finisher there, but he's not inept in that aspect of the game. And he's got this nice blend of on and off ball skill. He can play alongside of DeMar, and he's a lethal spot up player, but he can also create you efficient offense out of pick and roll. Their offense has been way better with him. And I know that this isn't going to matter to people because we're all baffled by what the hell the Bulls are doing. Why aren't they blowing things up? Why aren't they trading Vooch and LaVine and DeMar the moment that they can? But in terms of them being competitive this year, he's really saved their season, because with LaVine out, they needed a second shot creator. They needed a guy who could help float that offense. And that's what Coby White has done. And with where he was at last year, I did not envision that sort of leap within this season. So Jalen Johnson is so impressive because of the fact that he was just like a 5 point per game fringe rotation guy last year. But I think Coby's leap in totality, he's just in a tougher role right now. He's asked to carry an offensive burden that Jalen Johnson isn't, even though I would rather have Jalen Johnson for my team because he's such a perfect number three. What Kobe's doing as a number two is a little bit harder, and I think that that should be rewarded.
I just want to say my piece about Vooch. Dude, Vooch has to be one of the worst bigs in basketball. That guy sucks.
Okay, you don't need to say your piece. You said this last week. Know, you said dude, that they should start Andre Drummond over him.
Yes, dude. Nikola, dude, every game I watch, like, Vucevic legitimately is ass. That guy blows.
You want to know something, Logan? I remember back when Vooch was making his All-Star campaigns, 2021, before he got traded that year, he had, like, the most abhorrent on-off number I think I've ever seen. Like, the shitty Magic were way better with him off the floor, and they were just a bad team. And also, I was looking at him, and I'm like, okay, this guy is kind of a low-efficiency big whose entire value is offensive, and I was like, I'm not sold on the All-Star case. And then I remember some guy told me that he was a top 15 player, no doubt. And I said,
wow,
what?
Dude, I see what year you're talking about. The year he was traded to Chicago.
Yeah.
The Bulls were 9 points per 100 possessions worse with him on the floor. They were a, wow, this cannot, is this a real number? They were a 20-win team with Vooch on the floor. They were a 40-win team with him off the floor. Wow. And they were 8 points worse per 100 possessions defensively with Vooch on the floor. That's my dude. Vucevic does not know how to guard a pick and pop. It's actually comical, bro.
All right, we're not here to shit on Vooch. We're not here to shit on Vooch.
He sucks.
The last thing I'll say about Maxey, I love Tyrese Maxey. I've always been a Tyrese Maxey guy. I'm just not that surprised that he's been able to fill this void, especially when you consider that with Embiid out there, he has struggled. He's still producing in terms of raw numbers, but 54% true shooting is pretty brutal. And I think that volume and just leap in opportunity is a bigger factor with him. Obviously, he's a way better player than Coby White, but he was a way better player last year than Coby White. And so when you're just looking at the leap, the difference between this year and last, I think that Coby's is a bit more about that raw improvement. And that's what I like to reward most. All right, enough NBA, Logan. Enough NBA. We're going to talk a little bit of this NFL news because the offseason is still going off. And the most recent trade, the big one, at least before this Kenny Pickett stuff, Keenan Allen yesterday dealt to the Bears for a fourth round pick. How do you feel about this for Chicago first?
Yeah, I don't really know why everybody's hating on this deal for LA. We'll hit on that aspect in a minute. I think it's a big get for Chicago, the fact that you're not going to be paying him a crazy amount of money. Chicago still has a ton of cap space available.
Yeah.
And it's really beneficial for Caleb Williams coming into town. You know, a veteran presence, a guy that, you know, DJ is going to be your outside guy, and it's going to take a lot of pressure off of him. I think it's going to open up the field more. You can line Keenan Allen up in the slot. And, you know, I compared him. I remember we talked about Keenan Allen last year, and I compared him to Tyler Eifert, and that was super disingenuous. Allen's been way healthier recently. He's been way better. It just being available and on the field, and he's been a constant, man. Like, Herbert fed him. He was his only, like, reliable target with the Mike Williams and the Quentin Johnstons of the world. You know what I mean? Like, Herbert really had nobody else to turn to. And so I understand why Chargers fans may hate this. Like, Herbert is at a lack, is a deficit of weapons. The one thing I'd say is the Chargers have a lot of picks this year. I think they're going to invest heavily. I think Harbaugh is going to go crazy in the draft with college guys that he really likes. And I just have a fundamental theory about wide receivers. If they are not like the upper echelon, like the top 10 to 15, if they have a $20 million plus cap hit, it's okay, man. Like, you can let them go. Keenan's a guy who's aging. You're paying him a lot of money. Like, this is going to save the Chargers $23 million in cap. I would much rather have that than Keenan Allen. You get a pick back for him. So, like, I know that people always overreact because we're so used to the NBA trades when we get a Paul George traded for 5 first-round picks or we get a Rudy Gobert traded for 5 first-round picks. Football picks have different value. There are so many football players in the nation that a fourth-round pick is just going to be inherently more valuable, you know what I mean? Especially for a guy on this size contract. What I'm saying is instead of having an aging Keenan Allen on a big-ass contract, in that fourth round, guess what? You can draft a 21-year-old wide receiver that has fresh legs that you can scout and like. Wide receivers and running backs, you can find value in late in these drafts. Isaiah Pacheco, a starting running back on a Super Bowl-winning team, was a seventh-round pick. You know what I mean? You can find guys that work.
Yeah, like Quentin Johnston, first rounder.
Ugh. Nice one, LA. I like this trade mutually for both sides. I think this is a mutually beneficial deal. More importantly, though, I am very happy that Caleb Williams is going to have another guy that he can get the rock to. I do not like the offensive situation at all in Chicago. Even worse in the offensive situation, I do not like the minds in Chicago. I don't like the organization. I think there is a stink. I think there is a stench on this organization, and I think they need to get Caleb as much help as they can. I don't like Matt Eberflus. I really like very little of what they have going on in Chicago, so I think it's just a matter of getting as much talent and help for Chicago as humanly possible because I don't want Chicago to ruin this kid, and I do think that is a possibility. They did not set Justin Fields up to succeed. Please do everything you can in your power to set Caleb up to succeed, and they're doing that. So now that you have Keenan Allen and DJ Moore, I think they're moving in the right direction.
I like this for the Bears. I do want to quickly say first, we shouldn't conflate running back and receivers in the sense that you can find them wherever. They're kind of a dime a dozen because I think that receiver is clearly a more valuable position and less directly dependent on things around them like line play for their success and production. But what is true is that there's just a fuck ton of good receivers, man. I mean, every single draft we are seeing bona fide studs, not necessarily lower down in the rounds. A lot of the guys are coming at the top of the draft, but you're able to get these great players on rookie contracts. You think about Ja'Marr Chase and Justin Jefferson, like immediately being top five kind of receivers, certainly by year two. And so even though those are high draft picks, the dollar value is still cheaper than what you would be paying an established guy on a second or third contract or whatever. So I agree with that. And I think that there's a lot of speculation that LA is going to go with a receiver in the first round. Malik Nabers, I think there's a lot of talk for, and that would be great to get Herbert a dynamic weapon like that, who's young and affordable. Hopefully they don't do the whole Quentin Johnston type pick again and just miss in the first round. But for Chicago, they're in a very different position because they, unlike the Chargers, who are strapped for cap, have a bunch of cap, and they're a young team. And I absolutely think that bringing in an established veteran, a sure thing like this for Caleb, is going to be a positive. Keenan Allen is still so damn productive in his route running, his polish, just his maturity and consistency as a possession receiver, his hands, just a guy you can rely on third down, just a guy who is going to consistently help you move the ball down the field. So impressive, even though he's not that high-end athlete at this stage. I think it's great, and I think that DJ does bring some more of that dynamism. And now you got arguably two number ones. Like, neither of them are very good number ones. They're both insane number twos, and they're like pretty average number ones, I would say. So that's a really good situation for Caleb to be walking into. Obviously, Fields, a lot of people think, didn't have adequate help. Caleb is much more talented, I think, but is also walking into definitely a better situation.
I really hope. I wouldn't say much better. Keenan Allen helps. Chicago, to me, has to take an offensive lineman with that ninth pick. That, to me, yeah, was the
but
biggest issue.
Will.
Yeah, if they can somehow sneak, man, the other guys, I don't think it's Armarius Mims. I think Mims is mocked later in the first round. I like him. If somehow, if Joe Alt can fall to Chicago at nine, or, damn, what's the other? I gotta look at a mock real quick. There's another offensive
lineman. The other tackle,
lineman.
Is it Fashanu?
Yeah, Fashanu. Yeah. If they can notch either of those guys, because I really, Carson, I think this is one of the most open NFL drafts this season. The only reason I say that more than any other year is because of the quarterback volatility. Anytime there's an NFL draft when there's 5 to 6 quarterbacks that could potentially go in the first round, that just means that teams that don't need a quarterback or that are drafting later are just getting better football players later in the draft. And so I don't know if that means that, say the first three picks are all quarterbacks, does that mean that other teams are going to trade up into the top 10 to get the other QBs? Does that mean that other teams are going to trade up in the top 10 to get other skill position guys that they like Marvin Harrison or Nabers or Mitchell or offensive linemen? I think this draft has a lot of potential to be crazy because of the quarterback ability that we have here. But yeah, if it's Joe Alt that they can land, if it's Fashanu, I also like that kid out of Oregon. He's mocked in
Fuaga.
The mid-first round. Jackson Powers Johnson, the interior kid, the offensive, the center. I really like all three of those guys. And so if Chicago can come away with an offensive lineman and Caleb, or, because I don't think they're going to take wideout with the ninth pick, because the wideout crop is really good now. But I think it signals they're going to go O-line. Anyway, this is a really talented first round. Chicago has an opportunity to capitalize on a heavy QB class. Because like I said, that's how it works, man. When all the quarterbacks go up top, it just means that better talent is just going to trickle down to the rest of the first round.
Yeah. What I think is key about the situation compared to Fields' point is this is now back-to-back years. If they do take a tackle at nine or an offensive lineman, that they have invested a first-round pick, a top-10 pick, in the offensive line, and that they have traded for a star wide receiver. You do that in back-to-back years, man, you're taking it seriously in terms of just putting your guy in a position to succeed. And Fields got 1 year with half of that equation. Caleb should be walking into a more polished situation. I'm not saying that the Bears are great, but I'm saying they're doing the right things.
I mean, definitely
doing the right things just in terms of the positions they're valuing.
And I think Darnell Wright's a stud too, man. If you can somehow come away with another legitimately good tackle, I think they're set. The Bears are moving in the right direction. I think, I don't know, one of my friends said that they thought Caleb was going to have a, now that they got Keenan, he goes, yeah, man, he's going to have a better rookie year than CJ Stroud. And I said, hold your horses, Brody. Like, CJ just had the greatest rookie year ever.
Goat.
I can see the Bears maybe pulling together 6 or 7 wins with Caleb as a rookie, though. I think that's definitely
they won
attainable.
7 this year.
The Bears won 7 games this
year? Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if they can get much better than that. I think that's probably their ceiling again this year.
I don't know, man. If you think Caleb is that dude and you think Caleb is that dude, that offense could have some pop.
I think their division's gotten better. I think Minnesota got better.
The division's really good.
Green Bay
Did
got
Minnesota
better.
Minnesota get better? Minnesota doesn't have Kirko Chains anymore.
They didn't have Kirko Chains last year. I mean,
they had him for half of last year.
I think the Vikings are going to – I think their defense got monumentally better, and then I think that if they can get a – if they can get a QB, I think they're going to draft one. And again, I said this last pod, I would take Penix. If they can come away with a good young stud, I think Minnesota could be feisty.
Penix isn't young, though. He's 67 years old. I see what you're saying.
There's no distance too far for the perfect trip.
Hi, checking in for...
Or the perfect table.
Hey, where are you?
Coming!
And when you get access to Resi Priority Notify with your Amex Platinum card...
Hey, this looks amazing!
I'm so glad you made it.
And travel benefits at fine hotels and resorts booked through Amex Travel. It's worth the trip. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
What's up? I'm John Wall.
And I'm CJ Toledano, and we're starting a new podcast presented by DraftKings called Point Game. We're now joined by three-time NBA Sixth Man of the Year, elite bucket getter. Let's please welcome Jamal Crawford to Point Game. King of the Court one-on-one tournament. If they had it back in your prime, do you think you could have took it all?
I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think I could have took it all, but I think I would have shocked a lot of people. I think Kobe and everybody in their prime, Kobe would win a one-on-one contest.
Yeah, because you got to think, he's going to guard. He don't care about guarding.
He's going to guard.
He's going to guard. Like, you see him in the Olympics, he's going to guard. And then on top of
that. Like that, see that?
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Sam Cassell to Point Game.
I remember you came to my room crying tears. I mean, he was in a culture shock. He's going to withdraw us about winning.
Remember what I told you? I said, OG, you think I can get paid and go back and play in college because it ain't it?
Check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, DraftKings YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Have you been thinking about LASIK but not sure if you're a candidate? Just go to LASIK.com/quiz and take our free candidacy quiz. In just a few minutes, you'll know if LASIK is likely right for you. And if it is, we'll connect you with experienced LASIK doctors in your area. Start your journey towards 20/20 vision. Take our free candidacy quiz at LASIK.com/quiz. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Football news, Logan, that we're going to touch on. Aaron Donald, hanging him up. He's retiring, which I think sparks an interesting conversation. Do you view him as the best defensive player of this century? This time I was going to say TJ Watt. Watch.
Well, he's on the short list. This century is a tough question. There's definitely a lot of names that I would go to. Ray Lewis is definitely the first one. It's hard to surpass Ray. Ray's a goat. Ed Reed, in terms of playmaking, Troy Polamalu, two of the greatest safeties in NFL history. It's hard for me to say that between him and JJ, that's a real conversation, I think, on who would you rather have. And the reason would be it's, you know, JJ's peak is really hard to match, but it's like Donald's peak is also immaculate, and also he has a little bit more of the longevity, right? After JJ had his peak, you know, was just injured for a little bit. And then I think you have to put TJ Watt up there. Aaron Donald is one of three players to win three Defensive Player of the Year awards. Lawrence Taylor, JJ Watt, Aaron Donald. TJ Watt should be in that short mix. And again, I do think TJ is one of the greatest players of the 21st century. All of you detractors and Myles Garrett fanboys and people I do podcasts with want to take away from TJ Watt, but he's exceptional.
No. He's exceptional. I love TJ. Chill.
Yeah, but you always like throwing it out there like I'm overhyping the guy. TJ is one of the greatest defensive
players ever. No, I just
ever.
Know that you're going to go on like an 8-minute monologue. It's fine, bro. It's like what I do for Jokic. You got your guys.
Yeah,
there's nothing
wrong
with
it. It's my
guy,
man. I think you can put Aaron Donald up with any of their guys. And if we want to expand this conversation to Carson, not only is he one of the greatest players of this century, not only is he one of the greatest players ever, I mean, he's one of the greatest defensive tackles ever. There's only...
One of the greatest? He's got to be the GOAT DT. Don't give me Merlin Olsen.
Oh my gosh. I mean, there's six guys that I think you have to put up there with Donald.
Okay.
Joe Green, Bob Lilly, Warren Sapp, John Randall, Merlin Olsen, and Randy White. I don't think you can call Aaron Donald unequivocally the greatest defensive tackle ever. I think you could argue that he is, but all of those guys.
Didn't even mention Alan Page. He didn't even mention league MVP Alan Page.
I wouldn't put Alan Page up there with him. I think have bigger resumes. Alan Page is a GOAT. I would probably argue Mean Joe. I'd probably argue Bob Lilly. I'd probably argue Randy White. But I can put him over Sapp, John Randall, and Merlin Olsen. I would have Aaron Donald as my fourth greatest defensive tackle ever.
Whoa! Has there ever been a better pass rusher from the interior than Aaron Donald?
John Randall holds a candle to him in that regard. And I think they're both interesting, too. John Randall's
again with the holding the candle.
Randall's an interesting case because Randall, very similar to Aaron Donald, was undersized. And I don't know, man. Randall's got that. Randall was nuts. Randall was crazy. Yeah. Like, John Randall was actually crazy. That dude was insane. When we're talking about just pass rushers, I think Randall's up there. I think Donald is. That combination of size, speed, hands. In his peak, man, that 3 to 4 year peak, I think you could argue is the greatest by any defensive tackle ever. Consistently getting double teamed, consistently getting pressure regardless of the situation, just drawing so much attention. Well, on the flip side of this, I mean, how many players are you taking over Donald this century, Carson? I'm probably taking three, and that would be Lewis and both of the Watts.
Good question. It's tough to compare him to
it's
Ray.
Position. Yeah, man.
Because it's so different. Man, I think he's got to be top three. I don't know. The guy just wrecked games, dude. Just wrecked games. Like a combination of speed and power and technique from the interior.
Not to cut you off, I think Chris Jones is entering these conversations, yeah?
He's not as good as Peak Donald. I don't think DTs are as good as Peak Donald. Chris Jones is amazing, bro. He's amazing. Aaron Donald's just like an unprecedented force in the interior. Just completely destroyed games. And I think when you're talking about him against these other great DTs, he's kind of the exception. Like, generally, when people talk about the great defensive linemen ever, they think about edges. All the way back to Deacon Jones, you think about the dudes. If it's Reggie White, if it's Bruce Smith, all the great players of today who are going to generate these monstrous sack numbers. And Aaron Donald is, like, the one where he is going to do so many monstrous things that don't show up on the stat sheet, be better than everybody else just at the pressure that he generates from the interior, the run stuffing, and then also get home at a level that you just don't see. The guy had a 20 sack season from the interior. I think if we're talking peak, maybe I take JJ. What JJ did when he was healthy, like six healthy seasons, and he was first team all pro every year except for his rookie year. He's leading the league in sacks three of those years, putting up 20 sack seasons routinely, winning DPOY, again, the majority of the time when he's healthy. Like, that is just insane. But Donald definitely had the better overall career because he was healthier for longer. So that's my top three of this century. It's Ray Lewis, it's JJ, just because the peak is so unfathomable. Like, GOAT-level peak, truly. And Aaron Donald. And I think he is the best defensive tackle ever. And I can't sit here and say that it's like the NBA, where I legitimately go back and watch all of these dudes from every era with that level of detail. But I think the accomplishments, when you're just thinking about stacking first team all pro season, stacking DPOYs, stacking sack numbers per season, like, he's number one across the board compared to the other DTs.
Well, that's why I would give credence to some of those guys. I mean, Randy White has a Super Bowl MVP, I believe was 8 times first team all pro.
Aaron Donald probably deserved Super Bowl MVP.
Yeah, maybe you could argue it has a 16 sack season. Bob Lilly is one of the GOATs. I don't want to disrespect all the old timers, man.
I'm not trying to disrespect anybody. They deserve their credit. But Aaron Donald is one of one.
The speed and strength combination that's the one edge I would give Donald over all of those guys. Donald is the fastest defensive tackle with the best hands that I've ever seen. And it is a different game in terms of physicality. Like, I mean, dude, they're going to war in them trenches. You know what I mean? Like, it's a lot more civil in today's game. But Donald still, dude, the speed.
Except for Christian Wilkins, am I right? Always grabbing my QB's balls.
Bro, I saw that video after we did the show. That's crazy, so disturbing. Like, dude.
Yeah.
Look, bro, if a dude is fondling my balls in the game, we're fighting, bro. I'm scrapping. Like, we're going to war, bro. we're going to war.
Josh just took that shit out on the field. He just averages 300 yards and 4 touchdowns a game against the Dolphins.
I remember, dude, there was this really this is a gross tangent. There was this one center for the Steelers, man, I remember. His name escapes me right now. He was not very good, dude. There was this one game where I remember, bro, he did some of that Christian Wilkins stuff, and he started digging up a dude's ass one game, man. Like, he was getting up in there, bro, and it was gross.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing.
Yeah, man.
Is that the Anytime. Note we're going to end on?
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
You know that Mean Joe Green's name is Charles?
No way.
His name is Charles Edward Green. There is not Joe anywhere in his name.
Did you know that Kobe White's real name is Alec?
Did you know that Victor Oladipo's real name is Kehinde Babatunde?
I actually did know that one.
All right. Did you know that Ray Allen's real name is Walter?
Yeah. Did you know that Steph Curry's real name is Wardell?
Yeah, I did actually know that. All right, that was fun, guys. Wasn't that a great time? That's going to do it for us here today. Hope you all enjoyed. If you did, the good news is there's plenty more Nerd Sesh content on our YouTube page. You can find all our full shows, and you can find our video essays. I got one of those coming this weekend on the NBA. Who will it be on? Who knows? We also are doing our Trivia Gauntlet game on YouTube and on the audio podcast feed now, where, of course, you can just hear all of our shows. You can follow us across social, TikTok at NerdSesh. But if big government takes TikTok away, please also follow us on Instagram at NerdSesh and Twitter at Nerd_Sesh so that you do not lose us from your life. You can also check out our merch. Logan's got the hat on. We got the flags behind us. All that at thevolume.com. And you can join our Discord with the chance to talk to the one and only Matthew Spawnhour. These days, kind of my lead op, Matthew Spawnhour, with the anti-Jordan propaganda that he's pushing. And if you want to fight back against bronze sexuality, just blatant, unfiltered, unchallenged bronze sexuality, then you have an opportunity to do it. Or if you want to participate in it, you can do that as well. Our Discord is very pro free speech. So with that, as always, appreciate you guys. I've been Carson Brabber.
I have been Logan Camden.
And this was Nerd Sesh.
Being a chef means keeping your cool in the kitchen.
It's up, it's up.
And with Resi Priority Notify and Global Dining Access through my Amex Platinum card,
right this way,
it's nice to try someone else's food for a change. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Getting ready to take on spring? Make your first move with the reliable performance and power of Steel battery tools. From hedge trimmers and mowers to string trimmers and more, right now, you can save $50 on select battery tool sets. Real Steel. Offer valid on select AK system sets through June 16, 2024. See participating retailer for details.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.